My name is Joel Muggy, and the title of this session is Revisiting Bethlehem, the Current Crisis in the Middle East. Just in case you were here last week, this is basically the same lecture I did last week under a new title, so you're not misled. You can feel free to leave if you've already heard this. I should say a word about myself and what I do, because that sort of sets the stage for the presentation today. Now, I should also say that this week I'm going to be doing three sessions on Central America, and then a session on what we call liberating education with Jody Kretzmann on Friday night. I direct the Center for Global Education, which is at Augsburg College in Minneapolis, and there are really two goals, I think, two overriding goals of our program. One is what we call the internationalization of mission. That is, we seek to help people in this country understand and experience the ministry of Christians in other countries, particularly the countries in the third world, to us. That is, we believe that as the church, we don't necessarily have that mission ought to be two-way. We don't have... it's not our task to necessarily go and tell the gospel to people in other countries, but rather, in fact, there may be many times when it's appropriate for people of other countries to share with us the meaning of the gospel for them. The second goal, really, is what we call the democratization of U.S. foreign policy. That is, the idea that we as U.S. citizens have a right to have both an understanding of, an awareness of, the rules that govern our foreign policy, and also have the right and responsibility to help determine what that foreign policy is. But that the only way for us to be able to do that is to be informed about foreign policy. And so the way that the Center for Global Education carries out those two objectives, one of the ways, is through a coordination of educational study tours to many parts of the world. We do about 40 tours a year for church and community groups around the country. The majority of our tours have been to Latin America, especially Central America, but in the last few years we've begun to do tours to the Philippines, to various countries in the Caribbean, and to the Middle East. And so that's sort of the framework out of which I will share some of my experience and my thoughts this week, and it's out of many, many trips to the countries that we'll be discussing about, and talking with leaders, with grassroots people, with a wide range of people in and outside the governments in the countries that we'll be dealing with this week. So, any of you who would like more information either about the center or about our tours, I have a set of brochure here and a list of upcoming tours also. You can feel free to pick them up afterwards. All right, moving on to today's topic. I've been to Bethlehem twice in the last couple of years, and they were distinctly different experiences. And I want to just say a word or two about those two experiences. The first was about 2.5 years ago. And for those of you that have been to the Middle East, I think I experienced it at that time, much like you probably have. A very bustling, small little town. Nativity Square, the main square, full of huge tourist buses. Tour groups speaking just about every language, following their tour guide around with little signs with the number of the tour group. The Church of the Nativity just jammed with people trying to get down into the crypt. That's the traditional site of the birth of Christ. Arab shopkeepers selling all kinds of olive wood and all sorts of things, a very much of a carnival-like atmosphere. The most recent time in Bethlehem was in April, and it was a very, very different experience. There was no other bus in Nativity Square when we arrived. I don't know if this will ever happen to anyone again, but when we walked into the Church of the Nativity on the middle of a weekday, there was not another soul in the church. When we drove into town, into Bethlehem, it was as if there was no one in the town. Everything was closed up tight. I think the difference in those two visits to Bethlehem suggests something of what is happening in the Middle East today. As you probably know if you follow events at all, in April, Bethlehem was basically in a strike. Bethlehem is a Palestinian city today. And as a part of the uprisings that have taken place in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, Bethlehem was closed tight, and in a closing that's also being enforced by the Israeli military. As we drove into town, we'd see piles of stones along the side of the road and places where there had been barricades. And even later that day, after we had left Bethlehem, there was another incident involving a confrontation between Palestinians and Israeli police. Now, in the Middle East, so with that kind of backdrop, I want to take a look at our topic for this week. The Middle East has many conflicts, as you know, including the Iran-Iraq war, in which there have been very interesting recent developments. Soviet involvement in Afghanistan, our role, our involvement in the Persian Gulf. But the focus of my discussion today is going to be on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, perhaps the most pressing problem in the Middle East today. Now, why should we be concerned about that problem? The Israeli-Palestinian conflict threatens not only the parties involved, but potentially the rest of the world as well. It's a very critical spot for the potential involvement of nuclear powers, and in fact, with Israel now having nuclear capability, that potential is a very live one. Also, the Middle East has had more than its share of conflict in the last 65 years. Tens of thousands have been killed, disabled, or displaced in the Middle East in the last 65, 70 years. And finally, I think, as Christians who believe Christ came to reconcile humankind, and especially on a day like we are celebrating today, believing that Christ came to reconcile humankind to God and to each other, I think we owe it to our Jewish and Christian and Muslim brothers and sisters to understand who they are and why they believe and act the way they do. The city of Jerusalem, I think, itself is a kind of symbol of the roots of the crisis in the Middle East. Here is a city that is a holy city for the three monotheistic faiths in the world. It is the second most important site for Islam. The Dome of the Rock, which sits on Temple Mount, and that's the dome that you see in most pictures of Jerusalem, is the second most important shrine for Islam. It's the place from which Muhammad was to have ascended into heaven. And the place on which it sits is the site of the temple for Jews, and the site where the temple was destroyed, and the site where the new Jerusalem, the new temple, is to be built. So it is the most important site for Jews around the world. And finally, of course, Jerusalem is the site of the life and death, at least the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So for the Christian community, it is the most important site in the world. This is complicated, of course, by the fact that that the Palestinian or the Arab world is really also divided between Muslims and Christians. And I think this is something that many North Americans don't realize, and especially Lutherans. That there is a very strong Palestinian Lutheran Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, which has its headquarters in Jerusalem and is a very active Christian community in a very serious dialogue with its Muslim brothers and sisters, and very, very involved in the current struggle that's going on in the Middle East. And we had the opportunity on our last visit to have a good deal of interchange with our Palestinian brothers and sisters in the Lutheran Church of Jordan. But the Christian Church is very active within the Palestinian community, the Episcopal Church, the Catholic Church, and various dimensions of the Orthodox Church as well. So we see in Jerusalem that complexity of religious and national backgrounds that contribute to this crisis. Now, while there are certainly very significant religious roots to the conflict in the Middle East, I'm not going to focus on those especially today. I want to focus more on the historical and political roots of the crisis. And that means we have to begin to look a little bit at the history of what has happened in historic Palestine, especially in the last century or so. And so I want to begin with a little historical overview. And this is because of what we're trying to cover in one session. This is obviously going to be wanting and it's going to be superficial, but I hope you'll bear with me a little bit. I'm not going to be referring to the board too much, but I'll be mentioning some of the dates, and those are there to just kind of keep you on track a bit if you get lost. You'll see, of course, here a map of a rough map of Israel and the occupied territories. Here we have Israel, Jordan, Syria, the Golan Heights, which were annexed from Syria, taken in the 1967 war, Lebanon, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank. And you see Jerusalem here and Bethlehem in the West Bank. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. Okay. So it gives you a framework. And you have to be, one of the things that you have to keep in mind is how small all of this is. From Jerusalem to Tel Aviv is less than an hour's drive. And the distance from the closest part of the West Bank to the shore is something like, I don't remember the exact distance, but it's just a few miles.
Less than 10.
Yeah, I think it is. It seems to me it's like 7 or 8, I think. This, so the map is not a very good scale here, but it's very, very close. In many respects, it can be said that both sides of the conflict in are really prisoners of their own tragic past. In 135 AD, the Roman Emperor Hadrian put down the revolt led by Simon Bar Kochba, and Jerusalem and the temple were totally destroyed. Jews could not teach or practice their religion, they couldn't enter the city, and the Jews in other parts of Palestine faced death, deportation, and slavery. This forced migration perpetuated a dispersion that originally had been already taking place in 586 BC when the Babylonians conquered the southern kingdom and deported thousands of Jews into exile and slavery in Babylon. The following centuries of Jewish life in the diaspora, or the dispersion, it's referred to as the diaspora, were a period of intermittent acceptance, assimilation, rejection, and finally genocide, as we all know in Europe in the 30s and 40s, as they dispersed to Europe, Asia, and Africa. It was through that period that anti-Semitism emerged. Now, anti-Semitism as it emerged was a particularly Christian invention. The Jews killed Christ, or was the rationale. And it's a view that has been only rescinded by the church in the last 50 years or so, the official view that the Jews were the murderers of Christ. Another reason for the growth of anti-Semitism was that the response to Jewish intellectuals. Jewish intellectuals were hated often for their liberal ideas in the countries that they were living. They stressed individual rights and socialist values, and it was easy to lump them all together and judge them guilty. And finally, I think anti-Semitism emerged because Jews were viewed as a kind of mongrel race. And as perpetual aliens in the places where they lived, they were seen as people who exploited the misfortunes of the legitimate national population of wherever they were. And even think about some of our racist Jewish jokes in this country and the way that we portray people. Always viewed as outsiders, so they're easy targets to blame for any kind of problem. Now, Zionism as a political ideology arose from the specific anti-Semitic situation that existed in Russia before and after the turn of the century. The Jews were viewed as carriers of liberal ideas which threatened to undermine the powers of church and state, really the powers that be in Russia at that time. So the Jews were seen as a threat to that. And the powers that be then responded with something that became a part of the Jewish vocabulary since that point, with pogroms or spontaneous uprisings against Jewish communities involving looting, rape, and murder. And often the police stood by and responded to these in Russia only after the worst that was done. So between 1870 approximately and 1910, over 1 million Jews left Russia to the United States, some parts of Europe, and a few then, even during that time, to Palestine. Now, some did not want to settle in another alien country, still another alien country. They wanted their own nation where they could be responsible for their own lives and safety. For 18 centuries, they'd been praying each Passover that they might celebrate the next Passover in Jerusalem. So, what other place to go then? I mean, that was the natural place to be thinking about. So there, it was in that experience that Zionism was born as a Jewish political liberation movement. In 1896, Theodore Herzl, who is considered really to be the father of modern Israel, started looking for land. It was not always absolutely assumed that Palestine would be the place they would go. Herzl considered, among other places, various places in South America, Uganda, and Palestine. And he really did, Herzl really did want to try to find some place that there wouldn't be a population that would have to be displaced. But nevertheless, the Jewish sentiment was so strong that Palestine was really chosen then as the place to which would become sort of the goal of the Zionist movement, that the establishment of a state, a national state for the Jewish people in Palestine. Now, contrary to what most Jews had been told about uninhabited Palestine, the Jews discovered a land inhabited when the major waves of Jewish immigration began, a land that was inhabited already by many people, 500,000 Arabs, and even then about 66,000 Jews. Now, the Arabs had been living under Turkish rule since 1516, and many were longing for a national identity of their own. During the First World War, Europeans, and especially Britain, supported and specifically encouraged the Arabs to revolt, helping to keep the Turkish forces occupied, out of the way in Europe and away from Egypt and Suez. So Britain and other European countries wanted to really encourage an Arab revolt during the Second World War so that they would keep Turkey busy and that Turkey wouldn't get involved in Europe. And from their point of view, the Arabs hoped if they were successful, then the European powers would make good their promise to support the birth of an independent nation, an independent Palestinian nation, really, in Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Israel, and parts of Saudi Arabia and Lebanon. But the promises were not kept. The British, after the Arab revolt, the British took control of Palestine and Iraq, and the French controlled Syria. And even worse, Britain passed what was called the Balfour Declaration, which granted Zionists the right to establish a national home in Palestine. Now, one writer of the time describes the Balfour Declaration in the following way: a document in which one nation solemnly promises to a second nation the country of a third nation. I think we've seen other similar examples to that. But again, here was a very good example, I think, of precisely that kind of thing happening. Now, there was some protest on the part of the Arab population, but it really didn't become physically violent until 1920, when the Arabs attacked the Jewish quarter in Old Jerusalem. As immigration grew, more and more Arab tenant farmers were pushed off their lands during that period, during the 20s and early 30s. And often what happened was that Arab landlords were living outside of the country, and they would sell their lands for 3 to 4 times what it was worth to Jewish families, to Jewish settlers, and then the Arab tenant farmers were pushed into the cities and forced to work in factories at very low wages and so forth. And in some places, and if you have read the book Blood Brothers by Elias Shakur, I hardly recommend it, an Arab Malachite priest who lives in Israel, talks about his own history and the way in which the Israeli settlers basically pushed the Arab people off the land. In the 1920s and 30s, Arabs protested the large numbers of Jewish immigrants as they began to see the seeds of a Jewish state forming rather than just a home. And now, it's important to recognize here that as Oriental people with an Oriental culture, Arabs were forced to confront a largely European culture which was technically advanced and skilled in dealing within a Western political structure. Many of the Jews that were coming from Europe. And therefore, the Arabs were being forced to play a Western political game. They didn't know the rules of the game, and they refused to accept some of the rules they did know, and that, in essence, helped Zionists achieve their goals many times by default. For example, the British suggested in a legislative assembly in 1921, in which Arabs would have a certain voice in what was happening in the region. The Arabs had no experience with representative institutions in that way, and so they rejected the plan out of hand. And so when faced with imported strategies and imported thought patterns, Arabs often retreated to very uncompromising positions. And I think we still see a little bit of that today in the way that Arabs and Westerners interact. During the late 30s, after Hitler's Nuremberg laws, which were the laws that really began to provide the basis for the discrimination and eventual extinction of the Jews, Jewish immigration to Palestine grew dramatically, for obvious reasons. This increase in immigration led Britain, after the war, to attempt to limit immigration. Remember, Britain was still in control. That met resistance from Jewish terrorist groups. And I'll talk about that in a moment. So Britain submitted the plan to the UN, which proposed a plan which proposed a partition of Israel into Jewish and into two countries, really. The conflict escalated, and the British announced they would withdraw on May 14, 1948. The same day, the Zionists proclaimed the establishment of the State of Israel. Now, one month before the withdrawal, and was part of what led to the British finally to withdraw, the Jewish terrorist group Irgun carried out a massacre of 250 people, mostly women and children, in a Palestinian suburb of Jerusalem called Deir Yassin. The head of Irgun, who claimed responsibility for the massacre, was Menachem Begin. You all remember Menachem Begin? The other organization that claimed responsibility for the massacre was the Stern Gang. And one of the leaders of the Stern Gang at that time was Yitzhak Shamir, the current Prime Minister of Israel. The day after the British withdrawal from Palestine, several Arab armies, Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq, entered parts of Palestine to wage war in Israel. They hadn't accepted the partition plan per se because they really objected to Israel's presence at all. The result of the 1948 war was not an independent country for Palestine, but really the taking of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem by Jordan, and the taking of the Gaza Strip by Egypt. So for that time then, and then in 1950, the West Bank was formally united to Jordan. So what happened was not a partition into two states as the UN proposed, but rather a partition following roughly the boundaries that the UN proposed, but with the West Bank becoming part of Jordan and Gaza being a kind of territory of Egypt. Now, basically the Palestinians still did not have a national identity of their own. In 1964, the Cairo Conference was called to discuss the threat posed by the Israelis' decision to draw water from Lake Tiberias, here, and irrigate the Negev down here. Right, you can see what that would do to the West Bank. Their source of water would be diverted to irrigate the Negev Desert. So at the 1964 Cairo Conference was the place in which the PLO was recognized as the liberator of Palestine from Zionism. The following period then saw massive retaliation for Palestinian resistance and the Palestinians' constant infiltration raids. Then came the 67 war. In May of 67, Nasser announced the closing of the entrance of the Gulf of Aqaba to Israeli shipping. And that's down here. This is the Gulf of Aqaba. And so he announced the closing of that to Israeli shipping. On May 30th, Hussein of Jordan signed a military alliance with Egypt. And on June 5th, Israel, recognizing all the signs of a potential attack of the Arab countries against Israel, exercised a preemptive strike against Egyptian forces in the Sinai and against Jordan, and quickly destroyed Egypt's and Jordan's air force in one day, Israel did. Jordan continued to fight on for about a week, but it was rather useless. By June 7th, Israel had taken the West Bank, including all of Jerusalem, as well as Gaza and also the Golan Heights from Syria. On June 27th, the Six-Day War with Israel in possession or occupying those territories. On June 27th, the Knesset, the Congress of Israel, formally annexed the Old City of Jerusalem, that is, East Jerusalem. Until that point, until 1967, the Old City, the site of most of the historic sites, was part of Jordan. And it is Palestinian, and it's much of it is Palestinian. To date, most countries have not recognized this annexation. This is an important point, that most countries in the world have not recognized the annexation of East Jerusalem as part of Israel. The West Bank has not yet been annexed, and I'll talk about why in a moment. The PLO during that time operated out of... Oh no, let me jump back. In February of 1969, Yasser Arafat became head of the PLO, which united several Palestinian liberation groups. The largest were Al-Fatah, which was Arafat's group, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which was headed and is still headed by George Habash. The PLO at that time operated out of Jordan, which was a problem for Hussein because of the power that the PLO had and the fact that there were over a million Palestinians living in Jordan, and Hussein's not a Palestinian, he's a Bedouin. And so this always a kind of a competition for power. In November 1974, the UN recognized the PLO as representing the Palestinian people and gave them a seat on the UN General Assembly, or maybe I think it's perhaps observer status, I'm not sure. In 1978, the Camp David Accords, when Sadat and Begin came to terms, and the Sinai was given back to Egypt, as a result of that peace plan. Egypt was rejected by the rest of the Arab world because of that peace plan. In that very superficial overview, really, I haven't touched on everything I should have. In 1982, we should also mention that Israel attacked Lebanon, and I'll talk about the reasons for that in a moment. And so 1988 finds us with the Palestinians under occupation for 20 years and displaced for 40 years, a beaten people suffering from a loss of an identity and a loss of pride. The uprisings, which began in December of 1987, were unplanned, but they've not gone away. They have given the Palestinians a new sense of pride and unity and, perhaps what's most important, international recognition of their situation. The kind of international recognition that's really unprecedented. Now I want to focus on the shape of the issues today and try to help us understand a little bit who's whom and what the issues are. The central issue in the conflict today is the national claim of Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs to the same land. This land that you see constituted by Israel, the West Bank and Gaza. The claim of two peoples to the same land. And there's a tendency, I think, to define each people's national existence in a way that denies the other's existence. And I think given some of that historical past, that's not particularly surprising. The Israelis, centuries of persecution and exclusion, including the Holocaust, and Arab rejection of the State of Israel. Important factors in their point of view. The Palestinians, their self-identity from the rest of the Arabs is more recent than Jews, but it emerged because of dispossession of property and dispossession of rights in Palestine, and their refugee status throughout the Middle East. I mean, they're refugees wherever they are, right? There is no place where they are not refugees. And finally, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza by Israeli forces has been another important force in shaping their national identity and their need for an identity. There are also many other actors in the conflict, outside actors, that have an important role. For the Palestinians, their cause is seen as pan-Arab, and not exactly amenable at all times. The Israelis have few Middle East allies, but they have a powerful ally in the world Jewish community, and of course the most important ally for the Israelis is the U.S. government. And there are of course other actors as well, the Soviet Union, the Third World, Japan, and so forth. Now what are their positions? I'm going to try to frame the positions of these two parties in the conflict, see if we can understand them. First, the Israeli position. The Israeli position is actually rather diverse. Jews came for a variety of reasons, and the reason is because they came for a variety of reasons. Some came because of political ideals and commitment to build a state on socialist principles. Others came as survivors of the Holocaust because there was nowhere else to go. Some were religious, but the majority were not. The majority of Jews that settled Palestine, settled modern Israel, were not religious Jews. They are trying to forge a national identity, complicated not only by that diversity, but by the fact of 600,000 Palestinian Arabs that live in Israel proper, that is, in this territory of Israel. And this is also a fact that many do not realize, that there are 600,000 Palestinians in that territory who are citizens of the State of Israel, supposedly with full rights as citizens. However, they are excused from serving in the Israeli military. Many questions are faced by Israel today. Should they be governed by religious laws or by secular laws? Now what we see in Israel is a very uneasy combination of the two, combination of religious and secular laws. Is it important for Israel to be a democracy? Is a question that's being asked today especially. If so, then how does it preserve its Jewish character? How is it a Jewish state run by Jewish law if it's also going to be a democracy? Jewish law is not particularly democratic. The Palestinian issue, I think, is the single most important issue faced by Israel today. Now, there have been two major strategies towards the Palestinians within the Jewish government in recent years. The one is the one that can be generally said to be represented by the Labor Party, Shimon Peres, who was prime minister until about a year and a half ago, is now foreign minister. From that standpoint, or the more liberal point of view, I guess one would say in Israel, the West Bank is viewed as a bargaining chip to win a peace agreement with Jordan. Remember now, the West Bank is still part of Jordan officially, right? Occupied by Israel. The idea is to keep some captured territory for security, but return the most heavily populated Palestinian areas to Jordanian, but not Palestinian now, sovereignty. Is that clear? To return it to Jordanian rule, not to give it independence as a Palestinian state. And Israel will do that then if Jordan will make peace with Israel. So that's the labor perspective. And probably somewhat the perspective that the U.S. government and Schultz-Reese's recent peace plan would like to push. The more conservative wing of government, Likud, the part of that's currently in power with Shamir, the party of Shamir and Begin, For them, Israel's control of the West Bank is non-negotiable. Israel will control the West Bank. They have developed a plan for limited Palestinian autonomy in the West Bank and Gaza, but under Israeli sovereignty. Now, many of you have heard of the West Bank settlements, and the West Bank settlements are clearly a part of Likud's strategy. The West Bank settlements are large apartment complexes, most of them quite large, some of them smaller, but most of them large, that have been developed all over the West Bank for Jewish settlers. And these are often, they grow up beside an Arab community, often cut off their water supply. Sometimes they bring in new, quite nice highways that cut off the Arab highways. Because people who live in these settlements work in Israel and drive back and live in these settlements in the evening. Often, one of the problems with these settlements is that it's often the most anti-Arab Jews who have come to live in these settlements. They're the ones with the real pioneer spirit. You know, think of our own pioneer history and the kind of mentality. And often, it's interestingly enough, many of those have been immigrants from the United States who are the Israeli settlers in the occupied territories. So these are key strategy. The invasion of Lebanon in 1982, the Israeli invasion in Lebanon in 1982, was a Likud strategy to destroy the Palestinian infrastructure because the PLO was then headquartered in Lebanon, which would make the Israeli control of the West Bank and Gaza an easier task. Now we're seeing today that strategy has not proved very effective. It's not been very easy for them to control occupied territories. Now, in recent years, many Israelis have been diverging from those two main threads. Right? On the left, many believe Israel's refusal to deal directly with the Palestinians is a fatal flaw, both in it as a policy and in sort of the character of the Jewish people. What's happening is beginning to gnaw away at really the soul of what a Jewish state was supposed to be. And recognizing that most Palestinians do not want to live under Jordanian rule. And so there's a growing, small but growing body of Israelis who are seeing that the need for some sort of Palestinian state must be recognized. On the right, however, there are many moving away to the right of Likud who question the strategy of even a limited autonomy and have taken stronger stands against any sort of compromise with the Palestinians. The most extreme group is headed by, I think many of you will have heard of Meir Kahan. Have you heard of that name ever? Meir Kahan is a group that heads a growing number of people who advocate the removal of all Palestinians from Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. Eliminating them, moving them out. To where? Nobody knows. To the rest of the Arab world, I guess. So the Israeli population, I think, on this issue has become more divergent and perhaps more polarized over the years, though I think still the majority of Israelis would fall, the large majority of Israelis would not still support an independent Palestinian state. Now, one of the looming questions facing Israel is the potential annexation of the West Bank and Gaza. You remember I said earlier that Israel has not annexed the West Bank and Gaza. Anybody have any idea why not? Yes?
Palestinians would constitute a majority.
Not yet, but very soon.
Within 20, 30 years.
Right. It's a very important problem for the question of what kind of a state Israel is going to be. If we take that area as a whole, because of the difference in the birth rates between the Arab population and the Jewish population, I think the very early part of the 21st century, the Arabs in the occupied territories and Israel will outnumber Israelis. So, if the occupied territories were annexed and the Arabs given full rights as citizens, then Arabs would soon be the majority and it would no longer be a Jewish state. However, if it's annexed and not given the rights, then it would no longer be a democracy and in fact would have to become even more repressive to keep down the Arab majority. You see the dilemma it poses? So Also, because what we've seen in the last 4 years in Israel is the two major political parties unable to gain enough votes to hold power solely themselves because of more and more people moving both to the left and the right. So what you've seen in the last 4 years, in the last election, neither the Likud nor Labor was able to get enough votes to govern, so they have had a coalition government trading off the prime ministership halfway through the term. And this has really been a fact that has immobilized Israel in many ways. They have a new election coming in November, almost the same time as our election, and no one is quite sure how that election is going to turn out. Now, so the Israelis are divided, but the Palestinians are also divided, but in a little different way. The Palestinians are divided geographically. There are 600,000 in Israel proper, about 1.3 million in the West Bank and Gaza, and about 1 million in Jordan. There are about, by the way, 4 million people in the state of Israel, including 600,000 Arabs. Okay? I didn't mention that.
How many Arabs in the Golan Heights?
I don't know the numbers for the Golan Heights. I'm sorry, I don't. While Palestinians live in a variety of circumstances, and that variety of circumstances gives them different political perspectives, clearly, there is considerable agreement on the main priorities for Palestinians among Palestinians. Number one is the right to self-determination as a people. And number two is the desire for a sovereign state within historic Palestine. Somehow within historic Palestine. The PLO is the umbrella organization of several Palestinian liberation groups, and it is really a kind of government with leadership elected by a national council which represents a cross-section of the Palestinian community around the world. Initially, the PLO goal, trying to do too much in too short a time here, was to liberate all of Palestine and create a democratic secular state in place of Israel. Since the mid-70s, however, the PLO has been pursuing more of a political solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, emphasizing the establishment of a Palestinian state on a part, but not necessarily all, of the state of Israel or historic Palestine. A move that Palestinians say, now this would be important, is what we're saying, that Palestinians say implicitly recognizes the right of Israel to exist. Which this, as you'll soon see if you don't already, this becomes a sticking point. Most PLO principal member organizations, as a sideline here, prohibit terrorism against civilians. The vast majority of Palestinians, I think, could be said, number one, recognize the PLO as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, and secondly, endorse PLO entry into negotiations that will offer a reasonable prospect of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, so that most Palestinians do accept the reality of the state of Israel. Now, it's most likely, and most Palestinians will say, it's most likely that this would be a state confederated with Jordan, but there are some Palestinians that suggest a confederation with Israel might also be acceptable, because after all, we've had to live with them for these many years. and that there's a fear about what a confederation with Hussein might mean, because Hussein certainly is not, Jordan is not a democracy, and does not run on democratic principles, and if that what the Palestinians want is a democracy, then a confederation with a country that at least says it's a democracy might make more sense. The sticking point is that most Palestinians are not prepared to recognize the legitimacy of the state of Israel as a precondition for sitting down at the negotiating table. Without a similar recognition by Israel of the Palestinians' right to self-determination. Now you follow that? Okay? Palestinians are not willing to recognize Israel until Israel recognizes Palestinians' right to self-determination. And Israel won't recognize it until the Palestinians recognize them. You see, it's this mutual recognition that becomes the issue. Now, so what do they fear in this, in not moving towards this? The Palestinians fear a continuation of repression and discrimination that currently exists in both Israel and the occupied territories, and a continuation of this disenfranchisement. What Israeli fear, the Israelis fear, they basically don't trust the Palestinians once, if they were to give them an independent status. They don't trust that the Palestinians would allow Israel to exist. Israelis fear destruction by the Arab world around them. It's often, you hear it said in Israel many times, we can only, the Arabs can lose many wars, we can only lose one. They have not, the Israelis have not heard a clear official statement from the PLO that they will recognize Israelis' right to exist. PLO says, we have said it implicitly many times, but we're not going to say it officially until you recognize us. They say the first step has to be yours. How can an entity you don't even recognize you as your right as a state to exist? Basically, what the Palestinians are calling for is a settlement in which recognition would be concurrent. You know, that there would be a process of negotiations in which the recognition of each other would happen at the same time. And so what, again, I guess most would call for here within the Palestinian community, and increasing numbers, though still a very small minority within Israel, for a two-state solution to the crisis. Most Palestinians and some peace-oriented Israelis are willing to accept that. How would it function? Well, there's lots of thought been given to how it might function. It would be probably roughly concurrent with the current boundaries of the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip, not including Golan Heights. Golan Heights was annexed many years ago. I think there's not much chance of that moving back to Syria in the near future. But that the Palestinian state would constitute basically the boundaries of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, with probably some sort of corridor between them, at least the right of
easement.
Something. There you go. That's the word. each country would have its own right of return. Currently in Israel, if you were born in Israel, if you're Jewish, you have the right to return to Israel and settle. The same thing might be the case for Palestinians in the new Palestinian state. But it doesn't mean that there wouldn't still be, most Palestinians currently living in Israel would continue to live there. Most Jews living in the occupied territories now might continue to live there. But one would become basically a Palestinian state, a democracy in which the others had right of participation, and vice versa. Most Palestinians that I talked with are even willing to accept the idea of a demilitarized country, a country without an army in the West Bank and Gaza, in response to Israel's security concerns. One can imagine all of that. The point with where the imagination starts to get tough is when it comes to the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is considered, and neither side is willing to give up the idea of Jerusalem as its capital city. I mean, that's, Israel will not give up that idea, neither will the Palestinians. Some have suggested an international city in Jerusalem. That's the capital for both nations, a truly international city, which is a wonderful symbol. I mean, it seems to me that Jerusalem, for everything else it represents, if it would be an international city as well, it would be a marvelous symbol. So you see this marvelous symbol in juxtaposition with what seems to be something that's so far from the possibility, giving the enmity between two peoples. Finally, let me say a few words about U.S. foreign policy and then open it up to you. I've talked too long already. It seems to me one of the biggest roadblocks to a peaceful settlement in the Middle East, especially the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is U.S. policy. Now, what is the U.S. position? I had it described to me once by a U.S. political officer at the embassy in Syria in the following way. He said very sarcastically, we asked him, what is our position in the Middle East? He says, what's good for Israel is good for the U.S. And his He was saying it critically. It's very interesting. State Department officials in the Middle East, I find in the Arab world, seem to be a bit more enlightened than I experienced them elsewhere. Perhaps because they don't move around like other State Department officials do. The U.S. invests too much in teaching them Arabic, so they keep them in the region. So they develop more of an understanding of the Arab world. But he was very critical of the policy of our what's good for Israel is good for the U.S. And I think basically that has been our policy with various shades and over the years. The U.S. ambassador in Jordan, who spoke to us a couple of months ago, gave us an essence of some of the implications of that policy. For he said Palestinian self-determination is not an option. And the analogy he gave was his grandfather in Tennessee in the last century who wanted self-determination, but he couldn't have it. There are some situations in which self-determination for people is not an option. So he's using the U.S. Civil War, the Confederation, as an example of a people who shouldn't have had self-determination. The same is true of the Palestinians. The analogy seems to fall short for me in certain ways. He also talked about the non-viability of the Palestinian state. He said that economically this isn't a very viable entity, the West Bank and Gaza. As many Palestinians would say, what other country do we tell them whether it's a viable state or not? We have plans that can make this a viable economy, a viable state. You know, we and the Palestinian people are among one of the most educated peoples in the world today. And finally, I think the real stumbling block is the U.S. refusal, along with Israel, to recognize the PLO. Because the PLO does represent the vast majority of the Palestinian people. That's who they say is their representative. Current U.S. aid to Israel is over $3 billion a year. They're the highest single recipient of U.S. aid. The second, by the way, is Egypt. And the third, by the way, is El Salvador, just in case you didn't know that. And in exchange for that support, what does Israel do for us? Many things, really. They serve, among other things, as a surrogate for our policies in the rest of the world. When we finally couldn't back Somoza anymore in Nicaragua in the late 70s, Israel kept supporting Somoza right to the very end. When we withdrew our military aid to Guatemala because of human rights violations, in the early 80s, Israel continued to support Guatemala. There's very strong ties between Israel and South Africa today. Okay, let me quit there. I'd just like to suggest that, sort of a final statement, it seems to me that to support the idea of a Palestinian homeland is really not, Israelis argue against that on the basis of Israeli national security. I'd like to suggest that it's much more in the interest of Israel and its long-term good as a people and as a nation to try to begin to cultivate friendly relationships with its Arab neighbors. And the most, it seems to me, the one very strong step in that direction would be some sort of recognition of Palestinian self-determination. All right, I've talked too long. You have at me or each other or whatever you like. Here are your questions. Yes?
You ignored the 73 war. Is there any reason for it, or it just doesn't have...
It doesn't have quite the bearing as the other things do, but it's just too much history to cover in this time.
Were the Camp David Accords good?
Well, there's really a debate about that. Many suggest that certainly it settled the conflict between Israel and Egypt, but that Israel's intention was to do what it essentially did was divide the Arab world, divide the enemies against Israel. Some say, well, the accords didn't go far enough. It didn't go to deal with the question of the West Bank and the peace with Jordan. But it's precisely, many others suggest that's because the Israelis didn't want it to do that. It's as far as they wanted to go, and it's only now that Egypt is really being brought back into the Arab world and accepted again. So that many suggest that what it did was kind of take Egypt off of Israel's back so it could continue to occupy the territories with less pressure. Now, you know, it returned Sinai to Egypt. It did some things, I think, that were in Egypt's interest. But in terms of whether it really helped resolve the basic issues in the Middle East, I think that's questionable. It symbolically, it showed that two people could get together. But I think it was less, it's probably more in the interest of Israel than it may have seemed at the time.
Egypt's not doing bad. They got the Sinai back. They're getting
sure.
Messages.
Yeah. No, they're fine. Yeah. So. Right. No, it was good for them too. The question is, did it resolve the basic conflict in the Middle East?
There are some people who believe that the only thing Israel accomplishes for the Arab world is to unify the Arab world in the hatred of one person. But for Israel, they'd be fighting with each other anyway.
Well, there's some truth in that. I mean, that the Palestinian issue does unite the Arab world like nothing else does.
And I've read where Palestinians have said that even the Jewish prisons are better than the Jordanian prisons were.
Right. No, that's right too.
Hussein didn't exactly treat them well.
That's right, and that's why they don't want to go back under Jordanian rule. Jordan is not a democracy by any means. Yes.
Well, what about how sort of growing dissension within the PLO now? I mean, it seems to be even more divided than it has been in the past. And
yeah.
Now that it seems that even recently one of Arafat's aides has written this statement that seems to call for even, not even so much implicitly, it's more clearly stated about the possibility of it recognizing
right.
Israel and having two states there before, and then all the opposition to that. How does that...
Well, see, this is one of the things that, first of all, I think we have to recognize that the PLO really represents, in many respects, the moderate voices of the Palestinians. And that many suggest that it would be best for Israel to come to some terms with this soon, because the moderate voices of the PLO are starting to lose their force, including Arafat. I mean, we have this awful image of Arafat, an image that's been created much by I think our press and others. But Arafat is among the moderate. He looks scruffy, so everybody. But he's among the more moderate voices within the PLO, and the PLO itself is moderate now, as you said, Barry, really implicitly calling for a two-state solution. Most suggest that if something doesn't happen, then in 10, 20, 15 years, a two-state solution won't be an option, because it'll be younger Palestinians who have grown up in the refugee camps, who have grown up under occupation, that are going to start calling the shots here, and we're going to see a much more radical, much more kind of violent solution being called for. One of the things that really has happened even in the uprisings is that there's been a shift away from the focus of power within the Palestinian community from outside the occupied territories where the PLO is based to those kind of under the calling the shots with the Intifada, the uprising. So that really one of the things the uprising has done is given more power within the Palestinian community to those in the occupied territories. Because one of the things that's been the case before was the PLO, I said, was a representative group made up of representations from all parts of the Palestinian community. There were seats on that council for Palestinians living in the occupied territories, but they could never take those seats because it would have been too much of a jeopardizing their own safety to leave the occupied territories and go to a meeting. So they never did have the voice that many others did outside. And now, I think, as you say, Barry, there is division with the PLO, within the PLO, and again, it's really another just reason to suggest that Israel try to settle soon, because the opposition is going to get much more radical. And to this point, let me stop there. What I should do is end this session. I don't even know what's next on this clearly schedule, and then say whoever wants to stay and talk, I'm very willing to. But let me officially bring a close to the session, and then let you continue asking questions. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.